Good morning. We wanted to welcome all of you, but especially the second group of students we have from Michicut High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with us with a national award-winning program called Court with Class. It's a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. Under the program, we invite high school students from around the state to come join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, then the students are sent the briefs in the case we are about to hear, and they will meet with the justice after this second case. Everyone is invited to meet with the justice and the students, and the discussion will be about the procedure in the court, not the substantive issues involved in the case we're about to hear. So we have met the Michicut High School students, so let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on the far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right is Justice David Prosser. And Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you will meet this afternoon. And on the far right is Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I'll call the second case today, which is 06AP64CR, State versus Straszkowski. Is that the correct pronunciation of your client? And you are counsel of Philip J. Bream of Janesville, representing the defendant. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court. I am attorney Philip Bream from Janesville. I represent defendant appellant petitioner David Straszkowski, and he currently is serving a 15-year prison sentence, 5 years initial confinement, followed by 10 years of extended supervision. He served about 3 years and 3 months of that at this point. He is requesting that he be allowed to withdraw his plea in this matter. He is forwarding two theories, a Bangert analysis and Nelson-Bentley analysis. And this case is all about what it means to have a charge read in. And there's two cases at the Court of Appeals level that set that forth. State versus Cleaves, a 1993 case. State versus Zarkowitz, a 1990 case. In both of those cases, make it clear that read-ins are deemed admitted for purposes of sentencing. And what flows from that is that the defendant admits to the conduct at sentencing. There's no wiggle room for the defendant at sentencing. The court must necessarily conclude the defendant is guilty of the read-in offense. And I would go so far as to say that the trial court has a duty to factor in the read-in offense in the appropriate exercise of sentencing discretion. And I believe that it would be good public practice or good public policy for having trial courts telling defendants that read-in charges are deemed admitted. I would agree with the concurring opinion of Justice Nettenschein in the Cleaves case, where he talked about a defendant needing to know three things about read-ins. Well, first, that the defendant admits that he committed the read-in offense. Second, that the read-in offense can be considered at the time of sentencing. And third, that restitution can be ordered for the read-in charge. And in that case,
Concurring opinion, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That is correct. I think in the primary opinion in that case, the court did say that it would be good practice for trial courts to notify defendants of that fact.
And that brings the question to mind. I don't think there's any question that our case law, and I think you cited in Austin and Garski, that our case law indicates, in Sarkowitz, that a read-in is an admission of the offense. The question is, as I understand it, you brought this by way of either a Bangert or a Bentley motion. And is the responsibility on the circuit court to explain what a read-in is, or should there have also been in this case an ineffective assistance of counsel claim that counsel failed to advise his client or her client, since I don't know who the trial lawyer was, the counsel should have advised the defendant that this is the effect of a read-in charge?
Quite frankly, I think with a Nelson-Bentley motion, you probably would have to forward a theory of ineffective assistance of counsel. And I believe also, given what the proof would be for my client with a Nelson-Bentley type motion, it would be very difficult for him to prevail based on the findings that the trial court made in this matter. So I would be focusing more on a Bangert-type analysis at this point.
So what do you want the judge to tell the defendant?
What I want the judge...
Have a read-in. The plea questionnaire shows a read-in. The lawyer said in open court there's a read-in, right?
Yes.
Okay. What do you want? What kind of colloquy do you want in an ideal situation?
I think the colloquy isn't much different than what is already in a plea questionnaire. Right now, a plea questionnaire, in talking about read-ins, says that a read-in charge may be considered for purposes of sentencing and that it may lead to restitution being ordered on the read-in charge. I am asking that one additional line be put into the plea colloquy, and that would be that the defendant should understand that by having the charge read in, it is deemed admitted for purposes of sentencing.
Yeah, but one of the problems is you don't let the defendant plead guilty. Is admitting it different than pleading guilty?
I would argue that for purposes of sentencing, there would be no difference. I think if you plead guilty, obviously you're guilty of the offense. If you admit to the read-in conduct in the course of entering your plea, it is deemed admitted for purposes of sentencing. And I think that's a distinction.
So you don't want him to do anything else? You don't want him to tell him that this offense is burglary? And you don't want to tell him what the elements are, because he might say, oh, I didn't go in there to commit an offense.
And I understand that one could get to be very involved in trying to figure out all the possible ramifications that would relate to read-in charges. But I'm simply indicating that I think at a minimum it should include that language.
That the defendant understands he's deemed to have admitted, right?
Correct.
I'm sorry, you still?
No, I just want to make sure that that's just the very simplest, smallest thing you want.
Yes.
How can you be sure that the defendant understands he's admitted the charge if you don't have the court then go through all the elements? And don't we get into a whole other level of requirements for the circuit court?
Well, certainly that... could occur in situations. In this particular case, basically there was a second allegation of sexual assault, and the charge was dismissed and read in. And under those circumstances, I think my client would have understood what the sexual assault consisted
of. Maybe the second charge was theft, okay, rather than having the same elements as the charge of which a conviction, from which a conviction was made. So in that case, a separate and distinct offense, if it's read in, then is the trial court required to explain to the defendant that he is admitting all of the elements of theft?
I would say that that would not be required.
But how is it going to be a knowing, intelligent, voluntary plea then if he's admitting something and there, it hasn't been pointed out on the record for review that he knows what he's admitting?
Well, he is admitting it for sentencing purposes only, and there would be no other immediate consequences that would flow from that.
But counsel, if I can follow up Justice Rogensack's question, I have the same problem she does. If you're admitting to something but you don't know what you're admitting to, then we're going to be back here with exactly the same case in the future. Because he's still not going to understand that, well, I didn't know that that's what I was admitting to. I think that kind of brings to my in the Lancashire case where we thought we had this issue and it turned out we didn't. So it seems to me that in the absence of somebody going through, whether it be the court on the record or whether it be the court verifying on the record that the attorney had done it, that someone has got to explain to the defendant what the defendant is admitting to. Otherwise, the admission is not really valid.
I certainly understand the concerns of the court, and I would think that trial counsel would have a duty to speak with a defendant about read-in charges in general, and ultimately, I think the trial court is at a minimum required to tell the defendant that it's deemed admitted.
This is a case that involves, as I understand it, four alleged sexual assaults, and there's one that there's a conviction on, there's one that there's a read-in, and then there are two more in another county. And the court considered all of them in the sentence. Am I accurate?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the two in Clark County, there's the conviction and the read-in. And you want the court to go through certain requirements about the one that was read in from Clark County.
Correct.
Well, what about those in Chippewa County?
With regard to the ones in Chippewa County, the district attorney didn't have any authorization to make deals on those. And ultimately, I concede that the trial court has the authority to consider that other conduct in Chippewa County when imposing sentence. I would argue the difference between the two is that with regard to the Chippewa County cases, I think Mr. Straskowski would have had the ability to litigate the validity of those charges during the sentencing hearing. I would take the position that practically he does not have the ability to do the same with the read-in charge, that it is deemed admitted, and he can't come in and say, by the way, I did not do this.
But in the sentencing hearing, his counsel, I think, said he never says that he committed this offense. Am I wrong?
You are absolutely correct on that, and that's what concerns me about this case. You had a situation where the defendant goes into the plea hearing, he has the charge read in, and it's his belief at that point that he still has the ability to go into sentencing and to deny that read-in conduct. And not only did he have that belief, but his trial counsel also had that belief, and that just is not the case. I look at this as analogous to when a defendant enters a plea to a charge. If you plead to burglary as a criminal defendant, you can't go into sentencing and then say you didn't commit the burglary.
But you do have Alford pleas. And you can do it in the context of U.S. versus Alford.
I agree with you on that. I would also point out that with regard to Alford pleas, I do think that they are not favored by trial courts. And I do believe that trial courts also have the ability to not accept Alford pleas at the time of accepting a plea.
Don't trial courts also have the ability, when it comes time for a read-in, that if the defendant is contesting the circumstances of the read-in and maintaining one's innocence, doesn't the trial court have the ability to then reject the plea agreement that's before the court and force the case to go to trial?
Well, that would be my position, that that's what should happen in that situation. I don't think that a defendant has the right to take the good only with a read-in and say, I don't want that bad, you know, I'll have it read in so it's barred from future prosecution, but I'm not going to admit to that because I don't want that held against me at the time of sentence.
So the real question is whether or not the defendant has to have knowledge of what the read-in requires and what it means that the defendant is admitting to the charge and where that knowledge comes from, whether it has to be done on the record by the circuit court as part of a colloquy or whether it has to be done by counsel as part of preparation for the for the plea hearing, correct?
Yes, and it's my position that it should be done by the court for the reasons set forth in the concurring opinion in the Cleaves case. I think that it's good public policy. The amount of extra verbiage by the trial court is very minimal. The state, in their brief, admits that it's good public policy. If it's good public policy and it requires a trial judge basically to maybe add a line or two during the plea colloquy, I think that's good for the entire criminal justice system.
Yeah, I think it's going to require more than a line or two because, quite frankly, same concern that Justice Rogensack has, I don't see how a trial judge can do this without the defendant understanding the elements. Because you're admitting to criminal conduct, and you have to know what that conduct is and whether or not it's violative of the law.
With regard to a read-in charge, the charge has been charged, and it is set forth in a criminal complaint at a minimum. I suppose you could require the trial court to indicate to the court that the conduct alleged in this particular criminal complaint can be used against you at the time of sentencing and will be deemed admitted.
Is there a difference, counsel? In the Cleaves case, they said, okay, we're not going to require a personal admission to read-ins. What is the status of the law with regard to read-ins above and beyond that? Is the status of the law that the read-in is deemed to be admitted by the defendant? That is, that a read-in will be treated as if the defendant admitted the charge, or is the status of the law that with a read-in you are admitting the charge? What is it?
I believe at a minimum it is that by having the charge read in, you are admitting it for sentencing purposes, not necessarily broader than
but
that.
What case do you point to that gives you, and it may be a case I need to read, it's not Cleaves, because Cleaves doesn't say that, I don't think. What case are you pointing to say that a read-in, you understand you are admitting to the charge, as opposed to with a read-in, it will be treated as admitted? First of all, do you understand my distinction? One is we will treat it as though you admitted the charge, regardless of whether or not you admit it, regardless of whether or not you did it. We understand by allowing us to have a read-in here as part of the plea agreement, we are going to treat this as though it were admitted. Although we're not going to, under Cleaves, require a personal admission, we're not going to require perhaps a number of things, but understand that part of this bargain is that it's going to be treated as though you admitted it. That's one, as opposed
right.
to the other side being, the other interpretation being, we are, in entering a plea include that involves a read-in, it is an admission. you are admitting to the charge.
Okay, are you talking about the defendant affirmatively vocalizing that
No, Cleve says you don't need a personal admission, right?
Okay.
Okay, so which of the two is it? Is the defendant understand that he is admitting the charge, or is the defendant to understand that regardless of whether you admit it, regardless of whether you did it, we're going to treat it as though you did it?
I would say it is the latter.
And what authority do you have, if any? Sometimes you don't need authority. I'm just asking, what authority do you have so I can...
I don't have any specific authority that would go one way or another on that issue.
What difference does it make whether you say he's admitting versus he's deemed to have admitted? What difference does it make? Now, in this case, we got a little problem. No, I'm asking you. In this case, we got a problem because it's not that he admitted and it's not that he can be deemed to have admitted or be treated as admitted because he denied. He said, I didn't do it. Well, words to that effect, right?
Right.
So the problem in this case is, seems to me, if the defendant says, no, I didn't do it, clearly, it's not an admission. And then also, clearly, it's very hard for the court to engage in the fiction that you're treated as if you're admitted or you're deemed to admit it. It's hard, but not impossible. Because if it was not a reading, but it was just evidence of other crimes, the guy could say, I didn't do it.
Exactly.
But the court could consider it anyway. But the advantage on a read-in to the defendant is state can't prosecute him for it.
Correct. But I think part of that bargain is that he can't come into sentencing either and say, I didn't do this.
Okay, so you don't want him to have the best of both of all worlds. I didn't do it. You can consider it in sentencing, and then you can't prosecute me.
It comes down to more practicalities. You come into court saying, I didn't do this, especially in a sexual assault type case, I think that it raises a lot of other concerns because a primary consideration at the time of sentencing on a sexual assault is whether or not the defendant is going to take responsibility for their conduct and consequently whether they're going to be amenable to treatment.
Suppose, for example, this was the crime for which he pled guilty. It's not a sexual assault, it's burglary. The read-in is sexual assault. Is he eligible for 980?
He would not be eligible under 980, is my best recollection. I believe you have to be convicted of a predicate offense.
Okay. And now my other real question here is this. Suppose you are right, and the court says, terrific, we're going to now say you've got to instruct the defendant that by agreeing to a read-in, you are to be treated as if you admitted it. Or if you don't like those words, you can fill in what you do like. How does that help your client? Because with your client saying, I don't admit it, the judge backed off, didn't he? And then didn't the judge say, okay, but I'm going to consider it in sentencing because you've been a bad boy, you're up to your old tricks, you're engaging in meeting people that you shouldn't be meeting, et cetera, whatever the words were said. So what? Isn't it harmless error here? Even if we accept your rule, I don't think your client can benefit.
Well, and certainly that is a concern that I have had with this case, but ultimately I don't get to make the decision as to how to proceed in this case. I simply inform my client what his options are and then he makes that decision. Mm-hmm. I can conceive of a circumstance where he could be better off if he were to succeed in this case, and that being that he is allowed to withdraw his plea and potentially is able to show that the other allegation did not occur.
Let me ask this, counsel, because this is a concern that any time you have a plea withdrawal situation, My understanding is that the parties go back to the position they would have been prior to the motion to withdraw the plea, which means that he would be facing not only the cases for which he pled in this case, but now he's facing the charges as well that were part and parcel of the readings. So that, in fact, his exposure is now increased. He's facing additional charges, and he may be convicted of these offenses, and he may get convicted of the read-in offenses. By virtue of the trial that's heard, the trial court's going to have more information. So the trial court's not bound by the original sentence that the trial court's given. So now the sentencing exposure is increased. And I think that follows with the question that the chief had, that not only is this a situation where, arguably, is this a question of harmless error, but is not your client put in a worse position by prevailing?
And again, I think that comes down to what the client thinks he can accomplish with that otherwise ready in charge. And I agree that there is always a risk in a situation like this where a person may get to reopen their case and then all of a sudden have two sexual assault convictions. But certainly my client could also believe that he gets the plea opened and he's able to show the one didn't occur, and maybe he gets a resentencing, perhaps in front of another judge, and gets probation.
Counsel, may I ask just a couple of practical questions? So the judge, at the time of taking the plea, when the judge heard him say, I didn't do this, I'm not admitting it, the judge should have said, I'm not taking your plea then.
Well, that isn't what happened under the facts of this case, though. That didn't come about until the middle of sentencing.
Okay.
At the time of the plea hearing, there wasn't any protestation of innocence.
All right. So at that time, you think the judge should have said, well, if you are denying this, then I'm going to put you back in the position that you were. I'm not going to, I'm going to let you withdraw your plea and proceed forward on the charges. I'm going to let you withdraw your plea.
Certainly that would have been an option, but under the state of the law as it exists now, the judge would not have had any requirement to do that, and there was no intervening motion to do that.
But that's what you would have wanted to have had happen.
Practically speaking, I'd wanted all to be resolved at the time of the at the plea hearing so that these issues don't come about.
So as a practical matter, counsel goes out in the hallway, he comes in, he says, you know what, I am going to admit it, right? Or the plea is undone and he goes back to the status of being able to have a trial, right? Those are the two basic options that happen as a practical matter at the trial court.
Yes.
Okay, now let me ask you this, because I have some concern, you know, as to ramifications of statements people make at pleas. We know what happens when someone pleads guilty. It's not uncommon that people are sued civilly for sexual assault cases. And if they plead guilty, that's possibly used against them in a civil trial. If they plead no contest, it's not used, right?
Right.
What if they admit, as you would like the requirement to be here, but it's not a formal plea in either setting? That's used against them? And it's actually required by the court?
I would take the position that it is only deemed admitted for sentencing purposes, not for civil reasons and the like. And I see my time is up, but did you have follow-up?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Bremer. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Eileen W. Prey, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Prey.
Good morning. The state would like the court to hold the following in this case, and bear with me somewhat because there are five parts to this depending on how the court would go about looking at the case. First and foremost, the state would like this court to rule that the consideration of a read-in, a dismissed charge as a read-in at sentencing, is a collateral consequence of the plea. And therefore, although it may be good practice, and we agree it is good practice to inform an offender of the consequences of a read-in, an offender may legitimately, intelligently, knowingly plead guilty to an offense that has a read-in without being specifically informed of those consequences. If this court, however, finds that read-ins are a direct consequence, then the court urges, I mean, the state urges this court to find that in this particular case, Mr. Strazkowski was sufficiently informed about the general consequences of read-ins to make an informed plea. However, if this court finds that in order to have a knowing and intelligent plea, that there has to be knowledge on the part of the offender, and being either informed by the court or evidence that they had knowledge, that a read-in is an admission or deemed to be an admission only for sentencing purposes, that in this particular case, there is harmless error, because Mr. Strazkowski did not suffer that consequence. It wasn't deemed admitted. He was able to protest his innocence, and that wasn't held against him at sentencing. Alternatively, if this court does not, and it has rarely addressed harmless error in a Bangert context, if this court is not willing to address harmless error in this case, the state believes that it should find that there were no read-ins in this case, similarly to what you found in Lancashire. Because if this court identifies or defines a read-in as a dismissed charge that is not only considered at sentencing, but for which restitution can be imposed, for which the court can assume that the defendant admitted, for which perhaps because of that admission more weight is placed on it. If that's the definition of a read-in that this court comes up with, that the circuit court in this, the sentencing court in this case, did not treat that dismissed charge as a read-in. And finally, if we aren't unsuccessful in persuading the court on any of those four issues, and if a remedy is appropriate in this case, the appropriate remedy is not withdrawal of plea. It is a resentencing. The read-in is severable for the underlying conviction. And if I may remind the court that the protections, the Bangert protections, the constitutional protections, come about because of the fact of a conviction, not because of an admission to guilt. And this court most recently said that in Howell, relying on Boykin. Here, the read-in is not the consideration of a read-in at sentencing is a sentencing factor. It is severable from the knowing and voluntary plea of guilty to the underlying conviction. So that since the only result of having a charge read in at sentencing happens at sentencing, the remedy should also happen at sentencing. With respect to whether a read-in is a collateral or a direct consequence, I think we need to go back, again, differentiate between what's good practice and what is constitutional practice, that would allow somebody to withdraw their plea. The court is required to inform a person of the direct consequences of their plea, not the collateral consequences. And direct consequences are those consequences that are direct, definite, almost automatic, that affect the range of the punishment for the underlying convictions. Read-ins don't do that. Read-ins, unlike repeaters, a sentencing court can consider read-ins, but they cannot extend out the maximum punishment for the underlying conviction.
Sure.
I don't want to break your thought process. Thank you. Sometimes in life, if it walks, talks, and whatever, like a duck, it's a duck, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I want to focus in on direct consequence. Let's say I was a sentencing judge and I was going to sentence someone to 5 years on the underlying charge, but now there's a read-in offense, and I articulate this on the record and I indicate in my sentence that because of the read-in offense, I'm going to give you 2 more years, I'm going to give you 7 years. That sure seems direct to me.
Well, if that's direct, then what if the court says, okay, I'm looking at your work history, and you have an abysmal work history, and because of that, I think you need 2 more years of prison. Is the person's work history?
No, that's a good response. I bet you mooted, and you that's a very good response. But my follow-up is, you don't get sentenced for work history. You get sentenced for a crime, and it seems to me that you can draw a line there for the offense of battery, for the offense of sexual assault, I'm going to give you 2 more years. The others are considerations as opposed to a
But a read-in is not a conviction.
Oh, I know that.
And, a read-in can't be, you can't have a concurrent sentence, you can't have a consecutive sentence. A read-in is a sentencing factor.
Okay, now I'm not going to be a sentencing judge, I'm going to be a criminal defendant. And that gets me back to walk, talk, and smells. I know that I can only get, it's a direct consequence if I'm convicted of that read-in offense and get 2 years, and it's not a direct consequence if I'm not convicted but get 2 years. I mean, you're serving 2 years for it anyway. I mean, that's my tension.
For a more direct response than the work history. What about dismissed charges that aren't read in? What about the person's criminal record? What about pending charges? What about acquittals? All of these things, the law is that they can be considered at sentencing and that a court can take them into consideration in determining what the protection of the public is and what the rehabilitative needs of the offender are. So they can result in a harsher sentence.
But there is a distinction, Ms. Bray, because as I understand it, a read-in offense differs in 2 ways. One, you have an admission of the conduct by the defendant for purposes of sentencing that can be taken into account by the circuit court for purposes of sentencing. And two, you have an acceptance by the defendant that for purposes of restitution, the defendant will be held on the hook for purposes of the read-ins. So there are consequences that evolve as a result of that admission with respect to sentencing in this case, particularly with respect to restitution.
Well, let's look at both of those. First of all, let's look about restitution as coming as a consequence of having a read-in. Specifically, restitution has been found to be a collateral consequence. So a person does not have to be forewarned, and that is because it doesn't affect the range of punishment because it's been found that restitution is not punishment. Secondly, let's take a look at about this admission. And if we step back at how this came about to be put into the law, I would say, you look back at the 1971 Austin decision, and that decision, that was the first time that I'm aware of where they talked about a read-in being an admission. But in that case, they were talking about that there was a question whether you could have immunity, the state could provide immunity for a read-in defense. And the court said, well, because he's admitted it in exchange for that admission, then there can be immunity. Well, the underpinnings of that case is no longer good law in the sense that it doesn't require an admission anymore to grant immunity. Any dismissed charge that is part of a plea agreement, the state has to grant immunity under due process. So then following that, you come into the Czarkiewicz and the Cleaves cases, and those are dealing with the concept that in order to provide restitution, that the offender has to admit the conduct. Well, Czarkiewicz that first state that was before the restitution statute was promulgated. Now you have a restitution statute which defines what a read-in is, and if you meet that definition, you can impose restitution. It says nothing about admitting to the offense. It says basically that if a charge is dismissed as a matter of the plea negotiations and as a matter of that plea negotiation, the offender agrees to consideration at sentencing and it is considered at sentencing, then restitution can be imposed. So that this concept of the admission, and I agree it has gone down through, there are many cases that basically throw off the idea that it's an admission. I'm not sure that's a correct underpinning. And because the only thing in Wisconsin that defines read-ins is that statute on restitution, and the state is not aware that any other state has this kind of read-in procedure, this court may define read-ins as it wishes. And the state would suggest that because this idea of admitting the crime causes many problems, that this court should consider defining a read-in as not an assumed admission, and that, yes, restitution can be imposed under the statute, and, yes, it can be considered like any dismissed charge, but that it doesn't necessarily have to be deemed admitted.
So what would you tell the defendant?
There's a question of what's good practice and what's constitutionally required. I don't think that constitutionally that the court has to tell the offender anything about the read-ins other than that it's part of the plea agreement, and that should be part of the record. But as far as good practice, I think what now is in the plea questionnaire is appropriate, and which states to the offender that by having a read-in, he or she is agreeing to the consideration of the read-in at sentencing, although it cannot go beyond the maximum of the underlying sentence, and that restitution may be imposed, and that also that they, for the benefit of the offender, they have immunity from future prosecutions.
Does the plea questionnaire, I could look it up, but does it say, talk about admissions?
No.
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 That's what I assumed from
On that point, I would agree with many of the comments the court has made today that it's not, if you agreed with Mr. Struskowski, it's not a simple matter of including one more factor on the plea agreement saying that it's deemed admitted. I think there is a slippery slope there, that if the person is deemed to admit it, they have to know what they're admitting to. You'd have a plea hearing within a plea hearing. And the next question after asking whether informing them of the elements of the read-in would be, well, do they have to waive their trial rights? There was some suggestion in the defendant's brief that may be true. And to take it a step further, if you have to inform an offender of those kinds of things that may affect a sentence, although may not increase the range, do you have to start informing them of other sentencing factors that may increase the range of the sentence?
How does Wisconsin's law regarding this as an admission relate to other jurisdictions?
I think the read-in kind of situation is unique to Wisconsin. And I think in the way other jurisdictions operate as either taking things into consideration or a repeater type thing where the charge can be, where the sentence can be extended. In trying to analogize this to some other sentencing factors, the repeaters did occur to me. And repeaters are different from read-ins because they do extend the range of the sentence, so they are more a direct consequence than a read-in would be. But even in the case of a repeater, at least it's my understanding, that it's not automatically deemed admitted by the offender, that there has to be an appropriate plea colloquy. But if there isn't, the remedy in that case is not to invalidate the plea. The state is given an opportunity at sentencing to prove the repeater. And if at sentencing the state fails to prove the repeater, again, the remedy isn't plea withdrawal. It's that the sentence is that any part of the sentence that can be designated as related to the repeated is voided under 973.13.
Ms. Prather, what do you do with the language in Garski that says that the defendant should be advised by the trial court on the record of the effect of the read-ins?
Well, again, I think that's a good practice. And I think Garski, if you look at the holding of Garski, the holding is that it is an collateral consequence that a person can be, that restitution can be imposed as a result of a read-in on a probation.
Didn't they reverse with respect to the restitution in that case?
Excuse me?
Didn't the court reverse with respect to restitution in that case? The judgment and order are reversed insofar as they require restitution for, that's for the three offenses.
Yeah, I think it was for in different, my understanding of the actual decision in that case was that they found it was a collateral consequence. So that language I would take is more or less like the concurrence in Cleaves, that it is good practice to do that. And we don't, the state does not complain that it isn't good practice. I think it is. I think the more information that the offender has before giving away his or her rights to a trial, the better. But there's a difference between that and allowing a withdrawal of a plea. Again, going back to the facts of this case, it clearly all the parade of horribles didn't occur in this case. That first of all, Mr. Straskowski was informed of the general criteria for a read-in. He was aware that the court could take it into consideration at sentence. He was aware that the court could impose restitution. The limited area that he was not aware of was what has come down through the case law, that it would be deemed admitted. But deemed admitted, to refer back to one of Justice Bradley's questions, it's deemed admitted only for purposes of restitution, as far as I can see, and that's through Cleaves. It's not deemed admitted for any other purposes. And I think Justice Ziegler had a question about whether this admission would, in the future, could be used against him civilly. And I think that this court had a decision, State versus Robinson, and I don't have the cite right with me, in which addressed that in that case it was actually a civil action that the an offender was suing the prison system, and the question was whether his admission to the read-in could be used against him in that case, and the court found that it couldn't be, that it was restricted solely to the sentencing area. Which is, again, the same sort of thing with an Alford plea or a no contest plea.
May I ask a question of how a defendant who's charged with multiple offenses and, let me just give you a hypothetical. Suppose a defendant is charged with five offenses, same offense.
Mm-hmm.
Five burglaries, say. There are plea negotiations. He pleads to two of them. Two of them are read in. And he insists, I didn't do that fifth one. And it is dismissed. So three, four, and five are dismissed. Two are read in.
Okay.
How does the defendant know that the whole world is going to know he didn't commit that offense, didn't do that offense?
From your question, I gather that there are times when it's very important to a particular offender that he be able to deny that he did something. Sexual assaults are one of those kinds of things when you get in the prison system. I agree that it may be personally important to an offender to be able to deny. But the law in the area of plea withdrawals has been that just because something is personally important to a particular offender doesn't make it a direct consequence and doesn't make it something that the person has to be informed of before pleading guilty. It may be in a particular situation, and there's a Court of Appeals Brown's decision, there's a lot of Brown's decisions, but this one dealt with a case where there's a collateral consequence, and So there was no obligation to inform the person before pleading guilty of that collateral consequence. That happened to be sex offender registration. But it was clear on the record that that was very important. It was the reason why the person was pleading guilty to a specific offense, because he thought that sex offender registration wasn't involved with that offense. And the state thought it wasn't, and the court thought it wasn't. And they misinformed him about that. They gave him bad information about that collateral consequence, which was central to the reason for why the person was pleading guilty. In that case, the Court of Appeals said plea withdrawal was important, was warranted, because the person was getting misinformation about something that was central to the reason why that person was pleading. That hasn't occurred here. There is no allegations that, first of all, I don't think you can, that the defendant in this case can prove that the reason was that kind of central reason for the plea that was in Brown. And secondly, that he was misinformed by his attorney about his ability to admit or not admit, or by the state and by the court. So there's not, that sort of thing is not involved here. That's more of, that would be a sort of a Nelson-Bentley analysis. And I don't think that there is really a Nelson-Bentley kind of issue in this case because of that. Does that answer your question?
I'm not sure it did, but I'm not going to pursue it.
Well, are you asking whether that dismissed case can be considered in sentencing?
No, I'm really... There are obviously times when a defendant is charged with something that the defendant really didn't do. Now, you can have totally innocent people, and you can have people who have done a lot of bad things but didn't do a specific offense. And I was just trying to... There are going to be three charges dismissed, but they're not all the same. I mean, two are read in.
Right.
One is dismissed. You don't want to, if you're the defendant, you don't want to fight to keep that charge alive so that you can go to trial and prove yourself innocent.
Right.
I mean, that isn't a utilitarian kind of analysis that you go through. I'm just trying to figure out what, how do we distinguish one from the other?
And to me, that if I'm following your question, is one of the reasons why this concept of an admission for a read-in doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because we do not require offenders to admit guilt for the underlying conviction. There are Alford pleas. There are no contest pleas, as long as and that an offender can make a decision that it's in his or her best interest to plead to an offense because they know that they will most likely be found guilty at trial, even though they still insist that they are innocent. And we allow that.
How can a defendant be held accountable or responsible for restitution for an offense that the defendant did not commit? It's one of the values of at least the status of the law currently, in considering it to be an admission, that the defendant has acknowledged responsibility, so it makes perfect sense to hold the defendant accountable for purposes of restitution.
Well, it seems to me that it could be part of the plea negotiation that the offender, if the offender...
I didn't do it, but I can be held on the hook for purposes
of
restitution. So that you don't charge me for the offense.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's what you mean by you admit for purposes of sentencing, if you use that terminology.
You admit it really for purposes of restitution, to be more specific. The admission, as far as I can tell, really only comes into...
No, but it can be used to lengthen a sentence. Not over the maximum,
right? But
so can other things.
Other
right.
things. So can dismissed charges, and the state does not see any real difference between a dismissed charge and a read-in as it is considered at sentencing, other than the restitution issue.
That's why the state likes the plea agreement language
Yes.
over the admission language.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Suppose this court were to rule in favor of Mr. Struskowski in an opinion that says this read-in is a direct consequence. What's the next case Mr. Bram will be here with?
The next case will be, okay, it's a direct consequence that I admitted it. I don't know what I admitted. You needed to tell me the elements of that case so that I can knowingly and intelligently admit to committing that offense. And I assume we'll get one right away. And then maybe the next case will be, well, you told me the elements, but I'm giving up my trial rights on this for this admission. So didn't you have to tell me that I don't have the right to a trial on that one? And I really foresee that if the court goes in that direction, we are good. I mean, there are times when there are 10, 15 read-ins of various kinds of burglaries, and that you could have a plea hearing where, that becomes quite lengthy, where you have plea hearing within plea hearing, and this I don't think is required by the Constitution.
Well, and counsel, read-ins don't even have to be charged offenses. You can have an uncharged offense that's a read-in.
That's correct. That's correct.
Are there any other collateral consequences that would be natural candidates to be reevaluated? Let's put it that way.
I would not ask this court to reevaluate those things that it has found to be collateral consequences. But I will point out that defendant in this case suggested that collateral consequences are always those things where it is dependent on future actions of the defendant or on the action of another agency. So that's oftentimes true, but not always. The Court of Appeals has found in State versus Sutton that in truth in sentencing, the maximum terms of confinement, which is automatic, which is in every case, isn't dependent on any other agency. That's a collateral consequence because it doesn't extend the range. In State versus Plank, they found that under truth in sentencing, the elimination of parole and good time credits, which isn't dependent on another agency, isn't dependent on the defendant's actions. It happens in every truth in sentencing case that's a collateral consequence because it hasn't extended out the range. So I think the definition of a direct consequence is an appropriate definition, that it has to affect the range of the punishment. And one of the reasons, to me, this case really cries out for either finding a collateral consequence or finding harmless error, because it didn't. If you read the plea colloquy, it was done beautifully, really. And I read a lot of these. This one was done well. The court went through all the Brown requirements. The court didn't get just yes-no answers. He asked the offender to explain in his own words his understanding. It was done very, very well. Why should we allow the offender to withdraw his plea in such a case where really what the concern is something that's extraneous to that plea, that it only affects sentencing, and that in this case didn't even affect sentencing? It wasn't, the court didn't consider it admitted, didn't even consider that it occurred. The court treated it identically to the other pending charges. It treated what happened in this case was the offender had an initial appearance on the first sexual assault, the one for which he was convicted. And after that initial appearance, three more times, put himself in the identical situation where he was having relationships with young girls who were under 16, and put himself in a position to be charged or have allegations made that were identical to the underlying. And that's what the court found as being poor judgment.
Chief, if I may, quickly. If we would take the route, one of the routes that you suggest, that we redefine read-in not to be a admission of other crimes. If you take that route, do you get to harmless error or
or collateral consequences, is then the next step nowhere?
I think the analytical framework.
Right,
right. I think you would still have to decide whether it's a direct or collateral consequence. It would just come into the effect in the harmless error analysis. Because if it's a collateral consequence, the person the state or the court or the defense counsel wasn't required to inform the offender of anything dealing with the consequences of the read-in. So if I'm following that right.
Yeah, but then you still want to keep the language in the plea advisement form, which does advise that it can be considered for purposes, I think,
restitution. Yes, I think if the court were to find that it's not an omission, the plea questionnaire is still appropriate. And it's a proper statement of the law because it doesn't talk about admissions, and it's good practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bray. Mr. Bream?
I want to touch a little bit on that harmless error analysis that has been discussed. I think that in this case, the court did consider my client's denial of the read-in at the time of sentencing. The court used the term denial as it related to the read-in at the time of sentencing. And I think that has a very negative connotation in the context of sexual assault cases. Again, it suggests that the person is not amenable to treatment. I recognize that the court tempered its remarks somewhat at the post-conviction motion hearing, but that took place like a year later. And essentially, at that point, the trial court is trying to piece together in its mind what was going through its head at the time of sentencing. And I think that's very difficult for a trial court to do. And that is something that we should try to avoid having to have happen, if at all possible. I think that time does make it difficult for a judge to remember what happened. With regard to the discussion about direct or collateral consequences, I would agree that that really is a primary focus of the issue in this case. I don't believe that the issue is resolved by any of the examples that the state set forth in their brief. The state talked about whether someone becomes a sex predator or whether they have to register as a sex offender, whether they're going to get good time in the prison, whether certain conditions of probation are going to be set, whether they are going to become a habitual traffic offender. And I would argue that all of these are obvious collateral consequences because they are addressed in another forum, whether it's the Division of Community Corrections or the Department of Corrections or the Department of Motor Vehicles. Even the issue of the denial of good time, I think, is something that happens after the sentencing actually takes place. Ultimately, the whole purpose of having the distinction between direct and collateral consequences really is about making plea hearings useful. If you try to tell a defendant every possible consequence that could flow from a plea, what would end up happening is that you would have the judge going on for an hour about all the possible variations that could take place, and I think the end result is that you would end up confusing the defendant more than it was worth in the long run. Essentially, what I'm suggesting take place in this case is something fairly limited here, trying to make it clear to the defendant that the read-in action is deemed admitted for purposes of sentencing. And I think that is something that a defendant needs to know when trying to assess whether or not they want to go to trial. And I can tell you that in my experience as a trial attorney, there is a difference between whether a charge is dismissed outright or whether it's read in. At times, you try to negotiate a result with a prosecutor. The prosecutor says, well, we'll dismiss this and read this charge in. And all of a sudden, I have to look at the bigger picture and try to determine how that read-in conduct will be argued by the state at the time of sentencing. And I recognize that sometimes it is better for my client to push that case to trial and to be able to go into that first sentencing and say, we did not do that, Judge. Don't hold that pending charge against my client. We are going to have our day in court, and we're going to, you know, if we lose that case, then that judge can sentence appropriately based on that conduct. But don't hold that against the client at this point. And again, the difference is that you do maintain the right to deny that conduct at the time of sentencing. The state indicates that direct consequences have a definite, immediate, and largely automatic effect on the range of punishment. The state says that the read-in charges do not increase the maximum penalty. And that's certainly true, but I do believe that they impact on the range of punishment, especially if a court is exercising appropriate sentencing discretion. The court is going to look at that other criminal conduct in deciding what should be done. I disagree with the state when it suggests that this is not a read-in case at all. I understand the facts of the Lancashire case. In that particular case, the only time the term read-in was used during the course of the case was in the pre-sentence report. This case is different because not only was the read-in term used in the pre-sentence report, it was used at the time of my client entering his plea and also at the time he was sentenced. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Breen. Thank you, Mr. Breen. Thank you, Mr. Frey, for your excellent arguments today on the issue that relating to sentencing that continues to plague the courts. And so ends 06-AP-64-CR State versus Straskowski. The court's in recess for lunch until 1:30. The students should remain. They will be joined by their colleagues from Michigan High School, and Justice Prasa will be out to talk to you within a few moments. We are in recess.